Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... A poll published this month by the Washington-based Jewish Electorate Institute found that one quarter of American Jews believe that Israel is an apartheid state. 22% believe that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people, and 9% that Israel does not have the right to exist. With me today to discuss the startling findings of this poll, I'm joined remotely by senior Haaretz writer and former Israeli Consul General in New York, Alon Pinkas. Hi, Alon, are you well?
Yes, I am, Simon. Hi, Simon. Hi, Bradley.
And joining me in the studio, a man who doesn't know the meaning of the word retirement, Bradley Burston. How's it going, Brad?
It's going just fine, Simon.
Excellent. I think that might be the last time that we chuckle during this episode, guys. So let's plow on. Before we actually discuss the findings of the poll, which is just another in a long line of polls, reports, books, and articles that tar Israel with the apartheid brush, I think we ought to put our cards on the table. In a sentence, is Israel an apartheid state? Alon?
No.
Less than a sentence. Bradley?
If you had asked me in 2015 when I first wrote about apartheid, if this is an apartheid state, I would have said no. Now I would say that given Israeli policies over the years, yes.
Bradley, that puts you in a sizable and growing minority. Are you surprised that so many Americans, and not just young people, would describe Israel as racist and practicing apartheid, according to this poll?
I'm not surprised, but I think you have to look at it as a generational divide that is increasing. And I think that the way young Jews in North America look at Israel has changed radically over the years.
Mm. Alon, you know the American Jewish establishment very well. If so many American Jews, and as Bradley says, especially the younger generation, hold these views, have Jewish organizations failed?
Well, they haven't failed, but the disconnect that they have from a growing majority, not minority, a growing majority of American Jews, the disconnect is becoming evident in both voting patterns inside America, domestic election cycles in America, and in terms of attitudes, general attitudes on numerous issues regarding Israel. Some of these organizations have just, you know, exhausted their usefulness. They have a mandate or a mission statement that is no longer relevant to most American Jews, no longer relevance to the 21st century. And by the way, I know this is beyond the scope of our conversation, is no longer relevant to the Israeli-American relationship, which is part of their mission statement. So they failed, Simon, in terms of adjusting themselves, reinventing themselves, repackaging themselves. But more than anything, there is a disconnect. I mean, you know, outside of Third Avenue in New York City, where they mostly concentrate, these people are unknown to 95% of American Jews. Names that Israeli politicians roll off their tongues are not known to Mr. Cohen from Fort Lauderdale or Mrs. Levy from Portland, Oregon. They just don't exist as far as they're concerned. And that disconnect basically shows in this study, in this survey.
Mm. And in previous studies as well. I mean, the most yes. recent Pew survey of American Jewish attitudes showed a growing disconnect between American Jews or people who identify as Jewish in North America and Israel as an entity.
Yeah.
And indeed, in this poll, the top concern for respondents was climate change and not Israel and not anti-Semitism.
There have been many studies conducted by the American Jewish Committee, Pew Research, although they do it every few years, not on a yearly basis, and most recently, in recent years, by J Street, of Jewish exit polls. Once they identify you willingly as a Jewish voter and you're comfortable answering questions. One of the questions that they ask you is, what were the five, and then they expand it to 10, issues that concern, if indeed someone can name 10 issues that concern them, but what are your top five or 10 issues that were on your mind or that affected how you decided to vote? Mm. Israel never figures in the top five and seldom in the top 10.
And I think that when you talk about climate change and issues like climate change in particular, you're talking about something which is palpable, which is tangible for young American Jews. And I think that Israel, increasingly for the young, is a construction. It's not something real. It's some profile, some kind of two-dimensional profile of some form of a burden to many American Jews, and it's little more than that. It's little more than a burden. It's not a source of pride anymore necessarily, and it's not something which really is a real place with real people who have real feelings and who are themselves vulnerable, who are Israelis.
Mm. The poll also found that 9% of Jewish Americans don't even believe that Israel has the right to exist. If Ilhan Omar or AOC expressed those views, they'd be immediately slammed as anti-Semites, right?
Right, but, you know, well, first of all, there's a margin of error of 6 in that poll, so you know, the 9 could be 3, it could be 15 by that measure, but look, I haven't seen the cohorts of the study, but I'm willing to bet that of those 9% who ludicrously agreed with the statement that Israel has, I'm quoting, that Israel has no right to exist, many are from the extreme elements of the ultra-Orthodox community. And on the other side, that's where 0 and 360 degrees meet. You have the very radical, extremely radical left wing. And, you know, and that makes 9%. Yeah, that the figure sort of makes sense.
Mm. For me, the most fascinating result of the poll was the small margin between those who said that Israel's an apartheid state and those who said that Israel's committing genocide.
Yeah.
Because for me, that's where it really, where I see Israel becoming something of an academic exercise, where how you judge Israel is according to certain academic standards, not actually exactly what Israel does, because you're not even sure what Israel does. But you do learn in academia and other places that there are definitions of things like apartheid and genocide which are different from the way that Israelis look at those words and hear those words.
Mm.
Obviously, in the case of genocide, Israelis immediately go to the idea of Holocaust, Retzach Am, the mass extinction of a people, which they know they are not guilty of, where it comes to the Palestinians. But the UN definition is much broader and much more amorphous, and so you can, in America, you can say, okay, it's genocide because the UN said XYZ. And in the case of apartheid, I think when Israelis hear apartheid, what they immediately panic about is the idea of the threat of regime change. And what they're thinking about is, if they change this regime, it will turn into, on the strength of the apartheid charge, it will turn either into a regime they don't have any interest in living in, or a regime which won't allow them to live in it. And that's what they're really worried about.
Mm. Has the word apartheid been weaponized in the Israeli context, like some people say that anti-Semitism has been weaponized to delegitimize Israel and its very existence?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the moment you say apartheid, which, by the way, the definition of the term is unclear to most people who use it, as Bradley said correctly, as is the term genocide, which we connote with the Holocaust, or other people can draw a comparison to Pol Pot's Cambodia, or Stalin during the purges, or a very limited number of examples throughout history. But when it comes to apartheid, it's immediately negative. And I'm willing to argue with anyone on the merits of the case that Israel is not an apartheid. That does not absolve Israel of the occupation, of the negative manifestations of controlling the Palestinians since 1967, mostly controlling the lives of most Palestinians since 1967. But when it is used against Israel wrongly, and it has crept into the mainstream of the of public debate. I mean, 20 years ago, when you said apartheid, people would never dare say that Israel is apartheid. Then, you know, then you had some people pointing to a road to be used by Jewish settlers only, for which the use of which is prohibited for Palestinians. And they said, aha, that's a mark, that's an indelible mark of apartheid. You said, okay, come on, this is a security issue, and it's one road, and you do not, deduce or do not induce any of this into and conclude that this is apartheid. But it is definitely weaponized right now, because the moment you say apartheid, you're exempt from explaining what you mean by that. Mm. There's an occupation, yes, like any other military, prolonged military occupation. It is unfair. It is unjust. It's legitimate to criticize Israel for its part of failing to reach a resolution with the Palestinians. But to call Israel apartheid and immediately equate it with South African racism, which is where apartheid was born and where the term originates from, I think that would be misguided, misleading, and definitely weaponized.
Yeah, I think one of the more interesting aspects of this is the case of Benjamin Pogrin, the South African journalist and author who moved to Jerusalem in 1997. Mm. He was, for many, many years, the most prominent opponent of the accusation of apartheid when replied to Israel. But as Netanyahu took various legislative steps and declarative steps in the last few years, his opinions changed tremendously in terms of, is this apartheid or not? For him, the turning point was the nation-state law, because he began to reconsider the possibility that Israel was moving toward an apartheid situation. And then when Netanyahu openly advocated annexation of parts of the West Bank, but denying Palestinians their basic rights, you know, he was tremendously forthright, and at some point he said once we implement annexation, we're an apartheid state. It's apartheid, and I am deeply, deeply sorry to say it. Netanyahu, of course, pulled back, and he did not institute the annexation plan. But it was a startling, startling statement from someone like Benjamin Pogrin.
Mm. And it almost feels like Israel's trying to get off the charge of apartheid on a technicality, saying, you know, apartheid is something very specific to South Africa, and maybe we need a new word from Hebrew or Arabic and not Afrikaans to describe the situation.
The thing is, Simon, that traditionally when Israelis objected vociferously to any accusation of apartheid, they said there's absolutely no comparison, there's absolutely no valid or sentient analogy to the situation in South Africa. But then came the UN. Like Bradley mentioned before, the UN's definition of genocide, the UN also has a different, a slightly more liberal, quote-unquote, or amorphous definition of apartheid. And if you notice, politicians in the U.S., and I'm specifically alluding to the U.S. because the study that we all came together to discuss is only about the U.S. It's naturally in other places too, but politicians using that accusations, or academics or journalists against Israel, are now very careful, and they're saying apartheid-like behavior, apartheid-like examples, apartheid-like attitudes, apartheid-like policies, et cetera, et cetera. And Israel lost that argument because the moment it's apartheid-like and the UN's definition of apartheid does not subscribe 100% to the South African model, from that moment onwards, we needed to change the narrative. We needed to change the argument. But as Bradley said, in a different, slightly different context, when you had a prime minister like Netanyahu, who on the one hand considered himself to be a statesman of historical proportions and magnitude, but on the other hand toyed with the idea and used it for expeditious political reasons that the world is against us and he alone could stand up. So accusations of apartheid coupled with the BDS, the boycott divestment movement, whatever that is, it served him. So Israel failed because of that to develop a counter-argument. Now, there are counter-arguments based on the South African model and even based on what the UN deems to be apartheid by virtue of policies rather than an ideology. But we failed to do that. I don't know if this new government is going to take this seriously. But look at one other thing that perhaps is in the subtext of this poll, and I'd love to hear what you guys have to say about this. Israel has been accused of apartheid only when there's no so-called peace process.
Mm.
Whenever there's a peace process, however unsuccessful, however it ends, however or whomever is blamed for the failure, throughout the process, be it Oslo, be it post-Oslo, be it later on, Camp David and then Annapolis and so on, Israel was never accused of apartheid because there was at least a formal intention, an ostensible policy of ending the occupation. That it didn't work and never succeeded is a different matter. It's the apartheid thing only emerged and found itself inside the mainstream of public debate and discourse in the years where Israel not only did not engage in a peace process with the Palestinians, but was proud of it, ergo Mr. Netanyahu.
Mm. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think that something that goes along with this, that always accompanied this, was the fact that although apartheid is a radioactive word and kind of does have that kind of specter of regime change and threat to it,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting that when pro-Palestinian activists would observe that Israel itself had aspects of Jim Crow and the segregation of the Old South, that didn't seem to work. That didn't seem to have the same radioactive threatening effect. But at the same time, Israelis, to a great extent, got used to the idea that some form of segregation can be a positive thing, both from the security standpoint and also from the cultural standpoint. And that, as Netanyahu moved away from the peace process, he also allowed, I think tacitly, more segregation, or if you will, more apartheid in other areas, including, for example, separation of men and women in military context, but also in other contexts. Mm. And not only that, you have the situation of alienating non-Orthodox streams of Judaism, and sidelining them in the case of, for example, of the Western Wall Compromise, which was summarily dismissed to the dismay of Reform and conservative Jews everywhere, and that continues because there's still a tremendous sense of empowerment among those elements of the religious far right who want to make sure that the separation of sexes and the alienation of non-Orthodox Jews continues.
Mm. Alon, you wrote after the Human Rights Watch report came out a few months ago, saying that annexation would be a game changer in your position. Is that something that would push you over the line to calling Israel an apartheid state?
Well, not necessarily. But let me explain this. Depends. Look, annexation is a dumb thing. because it undermines the idea that the two peoples, the Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, should disassociate, should separate, should be in two different political entities. This didn't work until now. Whomever's fault it is doesn't matter right now. So annexation per se is a myopic, reckless, game-changing, demographic, and political game-changing thing, because the worst outcome of annexation is a Palestinian decision to disband the Palestinian Authority and basically say, you want us, you have us, the next stage of which would be one man, one vote. And if we deny them one man, one vote, then there's a case to be made for apartheid. Mm. The second element, Simon, is what exactly is it that you're annexing? Because if, you know, I never trusted Mr. Netanyahu's good faith on this, but if you announce, if you show a rough draft of a map showing a Palestinian state, and then you say, but these areas, according to Oslo, according to Camp David, according to Annapolis, according to even the Sharon Bush understandings of 2003 or 2004, rather, these areas will be incorporated into Israel anyway, say parts of Area C, according to the old Oslo division of the of West Bank into A, B, and C. If you only annex Areas C, and you do it with a semblance of not consent, but consultation with the Palestinians, and by the way, parenthetically, with Jordan, because part of what Mr. Netanyahu thought he was going to annex was Jordanian areas right next to the Jordan River, but that's beside the point. If that's the only area that you're going to annex, yet you provide some kind of silver lining for a political process in the aftermath of this annexation, then you're still not apartheid. But if you annex in an effort to disrupt any future establishment of a territorially contiguous and politically governable Palestinian state, then you would be very dangerously walking on the thin line separating between absolutely not apartheid, which I still subscribe to, and borderline, if not full apartheid, which detractors and critics of Israel call it already.
Mm. Are there any internal processes, Alon, that you see as following this line? I mean, we've mentioned the nation state law, the citizenship law, which fell on a technicality.
Well, you're asking a great question, because on the face of it, this government was formed with the weird coalition agreement or understanding that contentious or controversial issues will not be discussed or will not be acted on in order not to disrupt the harmony of the integrity of the coalition. And that precludes any you know, new nation state law, annexation, Palestinian state on the other side. Okay, on the other hand, I don't recall, maybe Bradley does, I don't recall that the Palestinians are party to the coalition agreement, and I don't recall that the Palestinians agreed to be forgotten for 4 years just because this is a weird coalition and the idea was to get rid of Netanyahu, and hey, you know, let's all kumbaya together, we got rid of him and we don't need to deal with you. Mm. There's going to come a point where this is going to have to be dealt because of Palestinian pressure, not because of American pressure, not because of European pressure, but there's going to come a point where the Palestinians are going to say, you know, okay, so this new government hasn't done anything to disrupt the status quo, but the status quo that existed just before this government is bad enough and incomparable to the status quo that existed when the peace process was effectively jettisoned in, say, 2014, last time it was even tried, but effectively 2009, last time it was actually negotiated.
Mm. I think what's interesting is that one of the primary markers of those who contend that Israel is an illegitimate state because of discrimination has to do with the parallel situation of support for the Israeli law of return, where Jews can return. Well, maybe return is the wrong word, but in any case, Jews all over the world can arrive in Israel and receive citizenship. Mm. as opposed to Israeli opposition to the right of return, the Palestinian request, demand for the return of Palestinian exiles. And what's, I think what's really fascinating here is that even though the left has not been able in Israel to do anything about this, the right has managed to undermine Israel's policy on both of these situations, because the ultra-Orthodox have been extremely activist in denying many of the requests of Jews to immigrate to Israel, either because they're conservative Jews or Reform Jews or converts or something, right? Mm. And so that saps the power of the law of return. At the same time, Netanyahu was instrumental in managing to get rid of one of the most apartheid-like laws in Israel, during, as Alon mentioned. Only the right could have done this, and here suddenly this law kind of opens the door to the right of return for Palestinians.
Mm. Bradley, if Israel were to leave the occupied territories tomorrow, and we were only talking about Israel proper, in quotes, within the 67 borders, could it still be argued that it's an apartheid state, or is it only apartheid because of the occupation?
Well, the answer is yes, it is only apartheid because of the occupation, but the occupation is so all-encompassing at this point, and we're all a part of it. We all benefit from it, but we all participate in it, no matter what we think. And that is the problem. I remember the bumper stickers all the time that said "Yesh Zekan," right? That mm-hmm.
Judea and Samaria
and Gaza is here. Yeah. Well, that's what happens. That's what happened with this government. That's what happened when Netanyahu took in far-right people. The answer is yes, it's only because of the occupied territories, but we can't seem to get rid of the occupied territories because of the power of the right.
Mm. Alon, is it possible that Israelis are so horrified by the accusation of apartheid because the campaign against apartheid in South Africa was ultimately successful?
Well, you're assuming that Israelis, one, understand what apartheid means and the repercussions mean in comparison to looking at the South African model, and the answer is no, they're not. And you're also assuming in your question that most Israelis care, and one of the tragedies of the last few years is that Israelis just live in, you know the old joke that denial is not just a river in Egypt. Well, denial, the Israelis are living in deep denial over the entire Palestinian issue. That is something that Mr. Netanyahu, sees or views as one of his great successes, but historically is going to be one of his gravest failures. Israelis don't give a shit, excuse the language, about the West Bank. They don't go there. They hardly know anyone living there. The big cities situated right on the so-called seam line, mm-hmm. right on the green line, separating theoretically the West Bank, Judea, Samaria from Israel, are mostly ultra-Orthodox cities. Israelis are not very sympathetic to the settlers, but they're equally not sympathetic to the plight of the Palestinians. So they just did the next best thing. They ignored it. And they went to restaurants, and they bought a new car, and they went to the Greek islands. And since there's no terrorism, Israelis think that the status quo is both sustainable and defensible. And every once in a while, you get a reminder from Gaza that it's not. But the people in Gaza are the Hamas, so they're easy to resist and hate. On top of all this, there is a general, it's almost part of the Israeli DNA by now, that the world is against us, mm-hmm. that the world is, which is, by the way, not true, but that's besides the point, that world organizations such as the UN, such as the ICC, the International Criminal Court in The Hague, such as UNESCO, such as the World Health Organization, and other, UN agencies that go by all kinds of acronyms, that they're so biased, unbalanced against Israel that no matter what they do, Israel will stand up to them. And so Israelis feel that they don't need a critical, investigation or examination of their own actions.
Mm.
add to this one last thing.
Yeah.
Usually, I mean, who is the occupier? The occupier is not the guy from the from Internal Revenue or the guy from the post office or the guy from the foreign ministry. The occupier is the army, the military. The accusations in the ICC are against the military. You know, the people accused of war crimes and infringement of rights and indiscriminate shooting at children are the army. Another part, another central part of the Israeli DNA is to defend the army, because the army is you and me and our sons and our children and our cousins and our neighbors. The army is us. It's not a distinct entity that Israelis can be. They can be critical of politicians, bureaucrats, banks, cable companies, cellular companies, what have you. But mm-hmm. the army, no. And so when you're accusing Israel of apartheid, as far as the average Israeli is concerned, you know, you're accusing the army, which is the military, which he sees as being, which he sees himself as being a part of, and it is being these accusations are leveled by organizations that are biased and anti-Israeli, or patently anti-Israeli. So no, I don't see an Israeli concern about apartheid.
Mm. Bradley, even with the rise of reports from within Israel, from Israeli organizations using the A word?
I would heartily endorse every statement that Alon just made, despite or perhaps because of the reports which are dismissed by that same kind of, you know, kind of extravagant denial.
You would endorse?
I would endorse okay. every single statement that you made, Alon. Okay. I just wanted to say one more thing. Mm. As a very young person in 1968, I visited Israel, and my relatives, Israelis, took me to see the West Bank. So he says, we have to go really fast, and we have to go right now, because we have to see it before they give it back. This was in 1968. They didn't go back. The same people who took me to see what was going to become Ariel and other places in the West Bank didn't go back to see those places afterwards.
Mm.
But it stayed a part of this.
And you've probably taken your grandchildren.
I have occupied these places. I have not taken my grandchildren. I hope my grandchildren will not have to occupy these places. And it's very important to me.
Guys, I'm afraid we're almost out of time for today. Before we sign off, though, just to let you and our listeners know that for the next episode of Haaretz Weekend, I'll be talking to Haaretz's chief sports writer, Uzi Dan, about the Tokyo Olympics. The lucky guys flying out to Japan to cover the games for Haaretz. And among the questions that I'll be asking him is, how come only two Israeli Arabs have ever represented their country at the Olympics? I think that's a pertinent question given today's discussion, no?
Well, I don't know why you think they're lucky going to cover a non-event like the Tokyo Olympics to begin with. But as for Israeli Arabs, they're mostly drawn into football, and Israel and football don't go together.
Well, Jimmy Turk, the football player who represented Israel back in Montreal, at the Olympics. At the Olympics. And a weightlifter.
Right. And by the way, there is a case to be made that if you take out all the Arab-Israeli footballers who play for the national team, we wouldn't have made it even to the low stages that we managed to make it.
Could not agree more, and as I say, I'll be putting those questions to Uzi Dan, and also asking him to predict how many medals we'll be coming back with. So I'll really be putting him on the spot. That's the show for today. Many thanks to Alon Pinkas.
Thank you.
To Bradley Burston.
Thank you, Simon.
And to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich. Join us again on Friday for an Olympic special. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.